relationship with people who refuse to let go. Once the termination decision has been made, your meeting with the employee is to inform him of your decision, period. Other issues may come up, but don't negotiate, no matter how much he wants to. This is not a discussion of how to improve things, correct things, change the past, find blame, or start over. Revisiting the issues and contentions of his history with the company will only raise sore points and raise emotion. He cannot likely be convinced that terminating him is a good idea. It isn't in his nature to recognize that, no matter what the evidence, so keep the presentation brief. I suggest to clients that they actually write a script of the few points they want to make in informing the employee of the decision. I also suggest they come up with what my office calls a boomerang line, a sentence that can be repeated each time he tries to derail the conversation. "Bill, if you had made this decision instead of us, we'd respect it," or "This is not the time to rehash the past. We have to work on the future." Keep the discussion future-based. Avoid rehashing the past. Establish some issues about the future to be resolved during the meeting. For example, what would you like us to tell callers about where to reach you? Would you like us to forward mail or advise the sender of your new address? How can we best describe your job here to future employers who may contact us? Make the employee feel that his input has bearing. Uncertainty about what a former employer will tell callers causes high anxiety, so address it directly and show that it is resolvable. This way, it's not left simmering beneath the surface. These points may seem minor, but they direct focus to the future, to his starting over again, rather than dwelling on the past. Be direct. Instead of simply informing an employee that the decision to fire him has been made, some employers saddle up to the issue so delicately that the person doesn't fully realize he has just been fired. After listening, he might say he understands he has to improve his performance, to which the employer responds, "No, you don't understand. We're firing you." This can make the fired employee feel foolish on top of all the other feelings that go with being fired. Trying to be delicate often results in being vague. There's a joke that seems at first to endorse delivering bad news in a roundabout way, but it shows that directness actually makes more sense. A woman calls the friend who is house-sitting for and asks how things are going. "Well, your cat fell off the roof and died," the friend reports. "My God," the woman replies, "how could you tell me like that? You should have said Fluffy was playing on the roof, having a wonderful time, and she began to slip. She regained her footing and seemed okay, but then she slipped again and fell off the roof. She was rushed to the vet, and the injury seemed serious, but then Fluffy rallied, and everyone thought she'd make it, but, well, finally she passed away. That's how you should have told me." The house-sitter apologizes for being so unfeeling. A week later, the woman calls again to see how things are going. The house-sitter hesitates and then says, "Well, your mother was playing on the roof." People benefit most from hearing bad news forthrightly. The whole theme of the termination meeting should be that you are confident he will succeed in the future, find work he will enjoy, and do well. You may actually feel he has emotional problems, is self-defeating, and will always fail, but there is nothing to be gained from letting these messages surface. The tone of the meeting should be matter-of-fact, not solemn and depressing. These changes are part of professional life that we all experience at one time or another. I've been through it myself. We know you'll do well and that this needn't be a setback for you. Cite general rather than specific issues. Many employers want to justify to the terminated employee why they are taking this action, as if they could possibly convince him that his being fired is a good idea. Others use the termination meeting for more efforts to correct the employee's attitude or improve him, turning the termination meeting into a lecture. Many employers give more frank and constructive criticism at the moment of firing someone than they ever gave that employee while he was employed. Forget about that. It's too late. A wiser course is to describe the decision in general terms. saying it's best for all parties. Say employment is a two-way street, and the present situation isn't serving either side. Say he is obviously a capable person, but this job is not providing the best environment for him to excel in. Do not get dragged into a discussion about who will replace him. Use a boomerang line, or say those decisions haven't been made. Remember the element of surprise. In consideration of the security and safety of those handling the firing, the employee should not be aware of the termination meeting ahead of time. Believe it or not, many employees are summoned to their firing meeting with the words, "They're going to fire you." Time it right. A firing should take place at the end of the day, while other employees are departing. This way, when the meeting is over, the fired employee cannot immediately seek out those he feels are responsible. Further, he will then be going home at the same time as usual, as opposed to finding himself home on a weekday morning, for example. I suggest firing at the end of the work week. If fired on a Friday, he has the weekend off, as usual, and won't feel the impact of having no place to go the next morning. Unlike on a weekday, he will not awaken with the knowledge that his former co-workers are at the job and possibly discussing him. He won't have the experience of everything being different from usual, different shows on TV, familiar people not at home, etc. Though some believe that firing earlier in the week is advisable, I find it makes possible targets of aggression available to him at work while he is still at a point of high emotion. Choose your setting. A firing should take place in a room out of the view of other employees. It should not be in the office of the person doing the firing, because then there's no way to end the meeting if the terminated employee wants to keep talking. The person doing the firing needs to have the ability to stand up and leave if it's no longer productive to stay. One experienced executive I know avoids using his office because he feels that a person will always vividly remember where he was fired and might return there if angry. Choose your cast. Who should be present? I suggest that a higher-level manager than the employee usually worked with should make the termination presentation. It should be someone distant from the day-to-day controversies that surrounded the terminated employee. It should be someone who is calm and can retain that demeanor in the face of anger or even threats. When workable, a second participant can be someone in management the fired employee is known to admire, or someone with whom he has had a good relationship. The reason for this second person is that the employee will act his best self in front of someone he feels likes or respects him. Who should not be present? Armed security guards, local police, or Big Ed from the loading dock should not be part of the termination meeting. Though some employers believe that this presence puts them in a position of strength, it does exactly the opposite. It sets all your vulnerabilities on the table for the potentially dangerous employee to exploit. No equal co-worker or direct supervisor should be present either. They increase the likelihood of embarrassment, along with the likelihood of getting into a heated discussion about the past. The manager running the termination meeting shows his strength by not appearing to need any reinforcements. Many employers view firing as something done from a position of power, but it's not so. There was a day when Richard Farley was the most powerful man at ESL. There was a day when David Burke was the most powerful man at US Air. They had anger and righteous indignation, and, as Emerson said, a good indignation brings out all one's powers. Righteous indignation can be the engine for behaviors that an employee might never have even considered before. Remember, this man is not a monster. He is someone they hired who might have worked at a company for years. But now he is in shock. This firing has shaken his world. Either he didn't expect it, or it confirms his view of the world because he always expected it. In any case, it's an unwelcome and belittling change that is being forced on him. He could stand not being liked in the company, but being ignored, rejected, erased, that is quite a different matter. The firing is much bigger to him because of what he links to it: loss of status, loss of income, loss of security, loss of purpose, loss of identity, and above all, loss in a fight. His opponents have won, and he has lost. Because of all of this, an important power shift takes place at the instant of firing. Everything changes as a wide range of options and alternatives opens up to the fired employee that he could never have applied when he was trying to keep his job. The primary leverage of employers is the ability to fire. But once they do it, once the power is exercised, their one shot has been fired and the gun is empty. After that, the power is in the hands of the employee. Many companies have learned that the cost of underestimating this power is far greater than the cost of respecting it. Given the industriousness of lawyers and the prevalence of wrongful termination suits, some companies have been more concerned about litigation than hazard. When a fired employee threatens a lawsuit, he may get more attention than for other threats. But this is ironic, because in the context of the kind of employee we're discussing here, the threatening of a lawsuit is actually good news. As long as he is focused on a lawsuit, he sees alternatives to violence. The problem with lawsuits comes not when they start, but when they end. We know that eventually, particularly when claims are unreasonable or outrageous, the employee will lose the legal battle. Then the company may have to face that person's anger again. When employers avoid provoking or engaging a fired employee, however, time itself will heal most wounds, hopefully including those to his dignity and identity. What is the best way to respond to threats in a termination meeting? In Chapter 7, I provided many concepts about threats that apply to this question. Remember that the value of threats is determined by our reaction. Accordingly, if an employee makes threats when he's fired, the best thing for the reaction is, "I understand you are upset, but the things you are talking about are not your style. I know you're far too reasonable and have too good a future to even consider such things." This reaction is not intended to convince the threatener that he isn't angry, but rather to convince him that you are not afraid. It's also important to let the threatener know that he has not embarked on a course from which he cannot retreat. A good theme is, "We all say things when we react emotionally. I've done it myself. Let's just forget it. I know you'll feel different tomorrow." Even in the cases in which the threats are determined to be serious and thus call for interventions or extensive preparations, we advise clients never to show the threatener a high appraisal of his words and never to show fear. This doesn't mean they shouldn't take precautions. In fact, when clients are firing difficult employees, we guide them through many precautions, including monitoring the meeting by video from nearby rooms, having security intervention teams at the ready, installation of emergency call buttons, and improved access control procedures after the firing. All termination meetings, whether they go well or poorly, provide valuable insights into how the fired employee is going to behave later. As important, this meeting also shows the fired employee how management will react to his behavior. Immediately after a termination meeting, the person who conducted the firing should make a report of the attitude, behavior, responses, and statements of the fired employee. The information can be assessed by professionals whose opinions can help inform decisions about security and other relevant matters. Among the issues to be decided after a difficult termination is whether anyone needs to be notified about possible risk. The failure to warn people who might be the targets of violence can be negligent, as can be the failure to take back access credentials, monitor an angry employee's departure from the building, notify security personnel and receptionists, or take any other steps appropriate when someone is believed to be dangerous to others. The worst possible reaction to a threat is a counter-threat. When threats work for the employee, it's because, having little to lose, he might actually do a reckless thing, and management knows that. Conversely, the employee intuitively knows that management will not do a reckless thing. Also, counter-threats make things worse. Think of violence as interactional. The way you respond to a threat might up the ante and turn this situation into a contest of threats, escalations, and counter-threats. It's a contest employers rarely win, for they have far more at risk than the terminated employee and far more ways to lose. Examples of counter-threats include management saying, "Oh, yeah? Well, I'll have the cops on you the minute you try it." Counter-threats engage the threatener and put you on his playing field. You want exactly the opposite, which is to disengage and to play by your rules. Having said this, I should add that there is also a time to let go of rules altogether. My office consulted on a case in which our client, a mid-sized city, put rules above safety. An employee who was retiring on a mental disability rejected the $11,000 the city offered because it didn't include a $400 reimbursement he felt entitled to. The rules prohibited reimbursement for expenditures that were not approved ahead of time, so the city refused to pay it. One afternoon, the ex-employee arrived without an appointment and demanded to see the administrator who had made that decision. The two argued, but the administrator held firm to the rules. The employee stood up and said, "Let me see if I can put this another way." He then placed two .38 caliber bullets on the administrator's desk and left. Our office was asked to assess the situation. We learned that this employee had shown a handgun to his therapist and commented on the principle of the financial dispute. Right is right, and right always wins. In our report, we suggested that the city pay the $400, since winning that point had become a matter of pride and identity to the former employee. Acceding to people's demands isn't always possible or practical. But in this case, the entire consequence was the $400. By the city's reaction to our suggestion, you would think we had asked them to give up their firstborn sons. The administrator told me, "We have rules. And if we buckle under to everybody who makes a demand, those rules will be meaningless." He could have benefited from the wisdom of Oliver Wendell Holmes. The young man knows the rules, but the old man knows the exceptions. Like the threatener, this administrator was committed to the principle of the matter. In such cases, we say both parties are in the ring, meaning they are willing or even anxious to stay in the fight. I said, "We aren't suggesting that you give $400 to everyone who asks for it, but rather that you give $400 just to the desperate, emotionally disturbed ex-employees who, after showing a gun to their therapists, plop bullets down on your desk to make a point. I don't expect the city will be paying out on that policy too often." But the administrator was clinging to some higher ideal than just the money. In fact, he was spending more than $400 just arguing his opinion with me. After he finished his second, more spirited lecture on the sanctity of rules, I wanted to bring us back to the high-stakes context. "I have a suggestion. Since rules are so powerful, let's make a new rule that says employees cannot shoot administrators. Won't that solve the problem?" He actually appeared to be thinking over my rhetorical suggestion when I asked, "Which rule would you rather see broken?" Wars have been fought over easier issues, but the administrator finally agreed to the $400 payment. The ex-employee moved to Arizona, and the city survived its brief affair with flexibility. Such resolutions may seem obvious, but when participants are in the ring, it's hard for them to see past their fists. Not a week passes without an organization seeking my advice on an employee who scares his co-workers. Reviewing so many situations with near identical features and seeing how they harm productivity, cause anxiety, and put people at risk, I've come to respect the value of avoidance and prevention. The corporations and agencies that have dedicated the time and resources to addressing these hazards before they occur have, in effect, elected to learn lessons second-hand rather than have their employees learn them first-hand. No matter how well managers manage, however, there may still be some violence in the workplace that doesn't reveal itself early. That's because it starts closer to home. What is it that employers who have had the worst outcomes did or failed to do? Of course, hiring is where it starts. The hiring officer has made a prediction that the candidate will meet the needs of the company and will be a well-adjusted, capable, and productive employee. We know predictions are better with more information, so investigating candidates' backgrounds is key. I don't mean that background checks can be expected to reliably screen out employees who will later act violently, because violence is a process that evolves over time. It's not a condition or a state. But effective background checks do give an employer the opportunity to learn important information about a candidate the easy way. I testified in a case involving a security firm called MacGuard, which employed a man named Rodney Garmanian. They gave him the uniform he used to lure an 18-year-old girl named Teek Dyer into his car. They gave him the car he used to drive her away. They gave him the keys to the locked building where he took her, the handcuffs he used to restrain her, the billy club he struck her with, and the gun he murdered her with. MacGuard had failed to conduct any pre-employment background check or even to review Garmanian's application. Had they taken those few minutes, they'd have learned that he failed to fill out most of the form, and what he did fill out was not favorable. He had listed his term in the military as being 3 months. That kind of thing is an obvious area for inquiry. Why were you in the military for only 3 months, Mr. Garmanian? Most people are in the military longer. He had listed his reason for leaving on two of the former jobs as fired. Yet, MacGuard didn't ask him anything about that. Perhaps the most chilling thing about this case is what I learned simply by calling two of his former employers. The first told me, "Oh yes, I remember Rodney Garmanian. He once tried to have sex with a girl on the second floor when the building was closed." The second person said, "Oh yes, I remember Rodney Garmanian. He drew sexually solicitous drawings and put them in the ladies' room." The murder Garmanian ultimately committed occurred in the ladies' room on the second floor of a closed building. For 25 cents, I had learned information that, had Garmanian's employers bothered to get it, could have saved Teek Dyer's life. Checking references and checking with former employers is an absolutely critical duty of every employer. Another case I testified in involved an employee who intentionally drove his truck at high speed through a line of picketers. Several people were injured, and one was brain damaged. Here again, there was an ineffective pre-employment inquiry. References were not called. Information offered on the application was not confirmed. In fact, just on the face of it, the application demonstrated a lack of full disclosure and a lack of honesty. For example, telephone numbers listed under references also appeared under relatives, and telephone numbers that, when dialed, went to people's homes were offered as being companies. Checking such things can tell you without much effort that the applicant is not honest. At a minimum, it tells you that there are some additional issues to be explored with him. Chapter 10. Intimate Enemies. You never do anything about him. You talk to him, and then you leave. Nicole Brown Simpson to police. I don't see how anyone could have had doubts after hearing the eloquent prosecutor describe the case. We all know the story. The murdered woman had reportedly suffered violence at the hands of the defendant for a long time, virtually since the start of their relationship. A few times she had called the police, and once she even brought battery charges against him. He was acquitted, but the violence continued. The day of the murder, she hadn't invited him to come along to a social event, and not long after 10 p.m., she was stabbed to death. The defendant told a friend that he'd had a dream in which he killed her, but later his lawyer said she was probably murdered by drug dealers. These facts became famous during the O.J. Simpson case, but the story I just told occurred thousands of miles from Brentwood when Nicole Brown Simpson still had 6 months left to live. The murdered woman in this case was named Meredith Coppola. If I told of all the other women killed in America this year by a husband or boyfriend, the book you are holding would be 4,000 pages long, and the stories would be stunningly similar. Only the names and a few details would change. I worked with the prosecution on the stalking aspects of the Simpson criminal trial, and later on the civil suit brought by the Goldman family. But I don't discuss the case here as an advocate. In one sense, it's nothing more than an example of this common crime. In another sense, however, it is much, much more. For American children who were under 10 in 1997, this one case dominated the news for at least 30% of their lives. It was all that was on daytime TV, all they saw on tabloid covers at their eye level at the supermarket, and all that the adults seemed to be discussing at the dinner table. It is, ultimately, an American myth about daddy killing mommy and getting away with it. Whatever your opinion of the case, that myth is part of its legacy. So are the many myths that were widely promoted by the scheme team, Simpson's criminal defense lawyers. They told us, just because a man beats his wife doesn't mean he killed her, and that's true. But what's that got to do with O.J. Simpson, who beat his wife, broke into her home, threatened her, at least once with a gun, terrorized her, and stalked her? That behavior puts him very near the center of the predictive circle for wife murder. The scheme team's observation is a little like saying, just because someone buys dough doesn't mean he's going to make pizza. And that's true. But if he buys dough, spreads it around on the tiny tray, adds tomato sauce, adds cheese, and puts it in the oven, then, even if Simpson lawyer Alan Dershowitz tells you differently, you can be comfortable predicting that pizza is being made. Why do I call the Simpson lawyers the scheme team? Because it reminds me that wife murderers and their lawyers frequently scheme to design defenses for an indefensible crime. Every murder discussed in this chapter, except those in which the perpetrators committed suicide after killing their spouses, was followed by some creative legal excuse-making. What was clear in the Simpson case is that while Ron Goldman may have been in the wrong place at the wrong time, Nicole had been in the wrong place for a long time. As Prosecutor Scott Gordon, now the chairman of L.A.'s forward-thinking Domestic Violence Council, said, Simpson was killing Nicole for years. She finally died on June 12th. This concept of a long, slow crime is what I want to focus on as we discuss predicting and preventing these tragedies. Despite the misinformation offered to the American public by paid advocates in service of just one man, there are many reliable pre-incident indicators associated with spousal violence and murder. They won't all be present in every case, but if a situation has several of these signals, there is reason for concern. 1. The woman has intuitive feelings that she is at risk. 2. At the inception of the relationship, the man accelerated the pace, prematurely placing on the agenda such things as commitment, living together, and marriage. 3. He resolves conflict with intimidation, bullying, and violence. 4. He is verbally abusive. 5. He uses threats and intimidation as instruments of control or abuse. This includes threats to harm physically, to defame, to embarrass, to restrict freedom, to disclose secrets, to cut off support, to abandon, and to commit suicide. 6. He breaks or strikes things in anger. He uses symbolic violence, tearing a wedding photo, marring a face in a photo, etc. 7. He has battered in prior relationships. 8. He uses alcohol or drugs with adverse effects, memory loss, hostility, cruelty. 9. He cites alcohol or drugs as an excuse or explanation for hostile or violent conduct. That was the booze talk and not me. I got so drunk I was crazy. 10. His history includes police encounters for behavioral offenses, threats, stalking, assault, battery. 11. There has been more than one incident of violent behavior, including vandalism, breaking things, throwing things. 12. He uses money to control the activities, purchases, and behavior of his wife, partner. 13. He becomes jealous of anyone or anything that takes her time away from the relationship. He keeps her on a tight leash, requires her to account for her time. 14. He refuses to accept rejection. 15. He expects the relationship to go on forever, perhaps using phrases like, together for life, always, no matter what. 16. He projects extreme emotions onto others, hate, love, jealousy, commitment, even when there is no evidence that would lead a reasonable person to perceive them. 17. He minimizes incidents of abuse. 18. He spends a disproportionate amount of time talking about his wife, partner, and derives much of his identity from being her husband, lover, etc. 19. He tries to enlist his wife's friends or relatives in a campaign to keep or recover the relationship. 20. He has inappropriately surveilled or followed his wife, partner. 21. He believes others are out to get him. He believes that those around his wife, partner, dislike him and encourage her to leave. 22. He resists change and is described as inflexible, unwilling to compromise. 23. He identifies with or compares himself to violent people in films, news stories, fiction, or history. He characterizes the violence of others as justified. 24. He suffers mood swings or is sullen, angry, or depressed. 25. He consistently blames others for problems of his own making. He refuses to take responsibility for the results of his actions. 26. He refers to weapons as instruments of power, control, or revenge. 27. Weapons are a substantial part of his persona. He has a gun, or he talks about, jokes about, reads about, or collects weapons. 28. He uses male privilege as a justification for his conduct, treats her like a servant, makes all the big decisions, acts like the master of the house. 29. He experienced or witnessed violence as a child. 30. His wife partner fears he will injure or kill her. She has discussed this with others or has made plans to be carried out in the event of her death, e.g., designating someone to care for children. With this list, and all you know about intuition and prediction, you can now help prevent America's most predictable murders. Literally. Refer the woman to a battered women's shelter, if for nothing else than to speak to someone who knows about what she is facing, in her life and in herself. Refer the man to a battered women's shelter. They will be able to suggest programs for him. When there is violence, report it to the police. This list reminds us that before our next breakfast, another 12 women will be killed. Mothers, sisters, daughters. In almost every case, the violence that preceded the final violence was a secret kept by several people. This list can say to women who are in that situation that they must get out. It can say to police officers who might not arrest that they must arrest. To doctors who might not notify that they must notify. It can say to prosecutors that they must file charges. It can say to neighbors who might ignore violence that they must not. It can also speak to men who might recognize themselves, and that is meaningful. After Christopher Darden's closing argument in the Simpson trial, co-prosecutor Scott Gordon and I joined him in his office. We read faxes from around the country sent by victims of domestic violence. But we were equally moved by messages from abusive men, one of which read, "You may have just saved my wife's life, for as I listened to you describing Simpson's abuse, I recognized myself." Unlike some murders, spousal homicide is a crime that can strike with conscience. Before any discussion on how a woman can get out of an unwanted relationship, we must first recognize that many women choose not to get out. Right now, as you are reading these words, at least one woman in America is being beaten by her husband. And now, another. For it happens once every few seconds. So while it's old news that many men are violent, we must also accept that a nearly equal number of women choose to stay with him. This means that many accurate predictions of danger are being ignored. Why? I can share part of the answer from my personal experience as a boy. I vividly recall the night when my sister and I ran out the door at 2 a.m. after hours of violence, afraid to go back home. We called the police from a payphone and reported two kids loitering so that we'd get picked up and taken to jail where we'd be safe. That experience and the years that led up to it helped me to understand that many women stay for the same reason I stayed. Until that night, no other possibility ever occurred to me. Before that night, you could no more have got me to voluntarily leave my family than I could get you to leave yours right now. Like the battered child, the battered woman gets a powerful feeling of overwhelming relief when an incident ends. She becomes addicted to that feeling. The abuser is the only person who can deliver moments of peace by being his better self for a while. Thus, the abuser holds the key to the abused person's feeling of well-being. The abuser delivers the high highs that bookend the low lows, and the worse the bad times get, the better the good times are in contrast. All of this is in addition to the fact that a battered woman is shell-shocked enough to believe that each horrible incident may be the last. Understanding how people evaluate personal risk has helped me better understand why so many women in danger stay there. As I learned from my experiences with violence as a child, many of these women have been beaten so much that their fear mechanism is dulled to the point that they take in stride risks that others would consider extraordinary. The relationship between violence and death is no longer apparent to them. One woman, who'd been at a shelter and then returned to her abuser, gives us a good example. She called the shelter late one night to ask if she could come back. As always, the first question the counselor asked was, "Are you in danger now?" The woman said no. Later in the call, the woman added, almost as an aside, that her husband was outside the room with a gun. Hadn't she just a moment earlier said she wasn't in danger? To her, if he was in the same room with the gun, or the gun was being held to her head, then she would be in danger. How could someone feel that being beaten does not justify leaving? Being struck and forced not to resist is a particularly damaging form of abuse because it trains out of the victim the instinctive reaction to protect the self. To override that most natural and central instinct, a person must come to believe that he or she is not worth protecting. Being beaten by a loved one sets up a conflict between two instincts that should never compete: the instinct to stay in a secure environment, the family, and the instinct to flee a dangerous environment. As if on a seesaw, the instinct to stay prevails in the absence of concrete options on the other side. Getting that lopsided seesaw off the ground takes more energy than many victims have. No amount of logic can usually move a battered woman, so persuasion requires emotional leverage, not statistics or moral arguments. In many efforts to convince women to leave violent relationships, I have seen their fear and resistance firsthand. I recall a long talk with Janine, a 33-year-old mother of two who showed me photos the police had taken of her injuries after one of the frequent beatings she received. She was eager to tell me about her husband's abuse, but just as eager to make excuses for him. Though the most recent beatings had left her with three broken ribs, she was going back to him again. I asked her what she would do if her teenage daughter was beaten up by a boyfriend. "Well, I'd probably kill the guy. But one thing's for sure, I'd tell her she could never see him again." "What is the difference between you and your daughter?" I asked. Janine, who had a fast explanation for every aspect of her husband's behavior, had no answer for her own, so I offered her one. The difference is that your daughter has you, and you don't have you. If you don't get out soon, your daughter won't have you either. This was resonant to Janine because of its truth. She really didn't have a part of herself, the self-protective part. She had come out of her own childhood with it already shaken, and her husband had beaten it out completely. She did, however, retain the instinct to protect her children, and it was for them that she was finally able to leave. Though leaving is not an option that seems available to many battered women, I believe that the first time a woman is hit, she is a victim, and the second time, she is a volunteer. Invariably, after a television interview or speech in which I say this, I hear from people who feel I don't understand the dynamic of battery, that I don't understand the syndrome. In fact, I have a deep and personal understanding of the syndrome, but I never pass up an opportunity to make clear that staying is a choice. Of those who argue that it isn't, I ask, is it a choice when a woman finally does leave? Or is there some syndrome to explain leaving as if it too is involuntary? I believe it is critical for a woman to view staying as a choice, for only then can leaving be viewed as a choice and an option. Also, if we dismiss the woman's participation as being beyond choice, then what about the man? Couldn't we point to his childhood, his insecurities, his shaky identity, his addiction to control, and say that his behavior too is determined by a syndrome, and is thus beyond his choice? Every human behavior can be explained by what precedes it. But that does not excuse it, and we must hold abusive men accountable. Whoever we may blame, there is some responsibility on both sides of the gender line, particularly if there are children involved. Both parents who participate are hurting their children terribly. The man more than the woman, but both parents. Children learn most from modeling, and as a mother accepts the blows, so likely will her daughter. As a father delivers the blows, so likely will his son. Though I know that dedicated constructive people want to educate the public as to why so many women stay, I want to focus on how so many women leave. Helen Keller, a woman in another type of trap, said, "Although the world is full of suffering, it is also full of the overcoming of it." Many batterers control the money, allowing little access to bank accounts or even financial information. Some control the schedule, the car keys, the major purchases, the choice in clothes, the choice in friends. The batterer may be a benevolent control freak at the start of an intimate relationship, but he becomes a malevolent control freak later. And there's another wrinkle. He gives punishment and reward unpredictably, so that any day now, any moment now, he'll be his great old self, his honeymoon self, and this provides an ingredient that is essential to keeping the woman from leaving. Hope. Does he do all this with evil design? No. It's part of his concept of how to retain love. Children who do not learn to expect and accept love in natural ways become adults who find other ways to get it. Controlling may work for a while, even a long while, but then it begins not to work, and so he escalates. He will do anything to stay in control, but his wife is changing, and that causes him to suffer. In fact, the Buddhist definition of human suffering applies perfectly. Clinging to that which changes. When men in these situations don't find out what is going on inside them, when they don't get counseling or therapy, it's a choice to continue using violence. Such men are taking the risk that violence will escalate to homicide, for, as Carl Jung said, when an inner situation is not made conscious, it appears outside as fate. Working closely with a domestic violence council, I've learned that for every battered woman who makes the choice to leave, we as a society must provide a place for her to go. In Los Angeles County, where 11 million people live, there are only 420 battered women's shelter beds. On any given night, 75% of those beds are occupied by children. In Los Angeles, we have a hotline that automatically connects callers to the nearest shelter. Through that number, established by Los Angeles District Attorney Gil Garcetti, battered women are taught how to get out safely. They learn to make duplicates of car keys and identification papers, how to hide these items from their husbands, how to choose the best time to run, and how not to be tracked when they escape into the modern-day underground railroad that shelters have become. I believe so strongly in the value of this hotline that my company funds it. I mention it here because every city in America needs such a number and needs to get it prominently displayed in phone booths, phone books, gas stations, schools, and hospital emergency rooms. An 800 number like ours, answered by people who have been there and understand the dilemma, is often more likely to be used than the alternative number, which I also recommend, 911. The reason for some women's reluctance to call the police is eloquently expressed by the case of Nicole Brown Simpson. In one episode, not revealed during the criminal trial, Simpson pushed Nicole out of a moving car in a parking lot. A police officer who happened on the scene told Simpson, "Take your wife home." In another incident, well after they were divorced, Simpson broke down the door into Nicole's home. A responding officer told Nicole his conclusion about what had happened. "No blows were thrown. He didn't throw anything at you. We don't have anything other than a verbal altercation." Nicole responded correctly. "Breaking and entering, I'd call it." "Well," the officer countered, "it's a little different when the two of you have a relationship. It's not like he's a burglar." "Absolutely wrong, officer. It's very much like he's a burglar, and it was breaking and entering and trespassing." After assuring O.J. Simpson that they'd keep the incident as quiet as legally possible, the officers left. By the way, the LAPD and the L.A. Sheriff's Department are now leading the nation in new ways to manage domestic violence cases. Earlier I noted that America has tens of thousands of suicide prevention centers, but no homicide prevention centers. Battered women's shelters are the closest thing we have to homicide prevention centers. There are women and children in your community whose lives are in danger, who need to know how to get out, and who need a place to escape too. Los Angeles, the home city of the nation's most notorious wife abuser, is, I'm proud to say, also the city with an escape plan for battered families that other cities can use as a model. Just as there are batterers who will victimize partner after partner, so are there serial victims, women who will select more than one violent man. Given that violence is often the result of an inability to influence events in any other way, and that this is often the result of an inability or unwillingness to effectively communicate, it's interesting to consider the wide appeal of the so-called strong and silent type. The reason often cited by women for the attraction is that the silent man is mysterious. And it may be that physical strength, which in evolutionary terms brought security, now adds an element of danger. The combination means that one cannot be completely certain what this man is feeling or thinking, because he is silent, and there might be fairly high stakes, because he's strong and potentially dangerous. I asked a friend, who has often followed her attraction to the strong and silent type, how long she likes men to remain silent. "About 2 or 3 weeks," she answered. "Just long enough to get me interested. I like to be intrigued, not tricked. The tough part is finding someone who is mysterious but not secretive, strong but not scary." One of the most common errors in selecting a boyfriend or spouse is basing the prediction on potential. This is actually predicting what certain elements might add up to in some different context. "He isn't working now, but he could be really successful. He's going to be a great artist. Of course, he can't paint under present circumstances. He's a little edgy and aggressive these days, but that's just until he gets settled." Listen to the words. Isn't working. Can't paint. Is aggressive. What a person is doing now is the context for successful predictions. And marrying a man on the basis of potential, or for that matter, hiring an employee solely on the basis of potential, is a sure way to interfere with intuition. That's because the focus on potential carries our imagination to how things might be or could be, and away from how they are now. Spousal abuse is committed by people who are, with remarkable frequency, described by their victims as having been the sweetest, the gentlest, the kindest, and most attentive, etc. Indeed, many were all of these things during the selection process, and often still are, between violent incidents. But even though these men are frequently kind and gentle in the beginning, there are always warning signs. Victims, however, may not always choose to detect them. I made these points on a recent television interview, and a woman called in and said, "You're wrong. There's no way you can tell when a man will turn out to be violent. It just happens out of nowhere." She went on to describe how her ex-husband, an avid collector of weapons, became possessive immediately after their marriage, made her account for all of her time, didn't allow her to have a car, and frequently displayed jealousy. Could these things have been warning signs? In continuing her description of this awful man, she said, "His first wife died as a result of beatings he gave her." Could that have been a warning sign? But people don't see the signs, maybe because our process of falling in love is in large measure the process of choosing not to see faults, and that requires some denial. This denial is doubtless necessary in a culture that glorifies the kind of romance that leads young couples to rush to get married in spite of all the reasons they shouldn't, and 50-year-old men to follow what is euphemistically called their hearts into relationships with their young secretaries and out of relationships with their middle-aged wives. This is, frankly, the kind of romance that leads to more failed relationships than successful ones. The way our culture pursues romance and mating is not the way of the whole world. Even here within our nation is another nation of Native Americans, whose culture historically involved arranged marriages. The man and the woman were selected by tribal elders, told to live together, and quite possibly, without a scintilla of attraction, told to build a life together. For such relationships to succeed, the partners had to look for favorable attributes in each other. This is the exact opposite of the process most Americans use, that of not looking at the unfavorable attributes. The issue of selection and choice brings to mind the important work of psychologist Nathaniel Brandon, author of Honoring the Self. He tells of the woman who says, "I have the worst luck with men. Over and over again, I find myself in these relationships with men who are abusive. I just have the worst luck." Luck has very little to do with it, because the glaringly common characteristic of each of this woman's relationships is her. My observations about selection are offered to enlighten victims, not to blame them, for I don't believe that violence is a fair penalty for bad choices, but I do believe they are choices. Though leaving is the best response to violence, it's in trying to leave that most women get killed. This dispels a dangerous myth about spousal killings, that they happen in the heat of argument. In fact, the majority of husbands who kill their wives stalk them first, and far from the crime of passion that it's so often called, killing a wife is usually a decision, not a loss of control. Those men who are the most violent are not at all carried away by fury. In fact, their heart rates actually drop, and they become physiologically calmer as they become more violent. Even the phrase crime of passion has contributed to our widespread misunderstanding of this violence. That phrase is not the description of a crime. It is the description of an excuse, a defense. Since 75% of spousal murders happen after the woman leaves, it is estrangement, not argument, that begets the worst violence. In the end, stalking is not just about cases of fatal attraction. Far more often, it's about cases of fatal inaction in which the woman stayed too long. Of all the violence discussed in this book, spousal homicide is the most predictable, yet people are reluctant to predict it. A man in Los Angeles was recently accused of killing his wife, three of his children, and three other family members. News reporters questioning neighbors about the accused murderer were told, "He always seemed normal." Another said, "He must be crazy." And another said, "I can't imagine that a father would kill his own children." As you know, if you cannot imagine it, you cannot predict it. When will we have seen this story often enough to realize that if several members of a family are killed, it was probably done by another member of that family? In this case, the man neighbors couldn't imagine was responsible for the murders had already tried to kill his wife three other times. He had also been arrested twice on domestic violence charges. Sounds predictable to me. So how does the system usually respond to society's most predictable murder risk? It tells the woman to go to court, to civil court, and sue her abuser to stay away. In many states, this is called a temporary restraining order, because it's expected to restrain the aggressor. In some states, it's called a protection order, expected to protect the victim. In fact, on its own, it doesn't achieve either goal. Lawyers, police, TV news people, counselors, psychologists, and even some victims' advocates recommend restraining orders wholesale. They are a growth industry in this country. We should perhaps consider putting them on the New York Stock Exchange, but we should stop telling people that a piece of paper will automatically protect them, because when applied to certain types of cases, it may do the opposite. It's dangerous to promote a specific treatment without first diagnosing the problem in the individual case. It's perhaps obvious to say that a restraining order will not restrain a murderer, but there is substantial controversy on the topic. While I warn that they should not be universally recommended because they aren't right for every kind of case or every stage of a case, most police departments encourage them all the time. Restraining orders, often called TROs, have long been homework assignments police give women to prove they're really committed to getting away from their pursuers. The orders do get the troubled women out of the police station and headed for court, perhaps to have continuing problems, perhaps not. And they do make arrests simpler if a man continues his unwanted pursuit. Thus, TROs clearly serve police and prosecutors, but they do not always serve victims. In California, for example, TROs are valid for only 14 days, after which the woman must return to court for a trial to determine if the order will be extended. Even with all the failures of the present system, there are those who aggressively defend it, including one psychiatrist who has been a loyal apologist for the status quo. At a large police conference, he trumpeted, "TROs work, and we have proven it." He based his reckless statement on a woefully biased study of a small sample of stalking cases that didn't even include spousal stalkers, the very type most likely to kill. In fact, if you work back from the murders, you'll find restraining orders and other confrontational interventions alarmingly often. The personal effects of a woman murdered by her estranged husband frequently include the piece of paper that psychiatrist assured us has been proven effective. How does he explain that? "Look at it this way," he says. "Some people die on chemotherapy. Some people die when they get restraining orders. But that doesn't mean that you don't do chemo or that you don't get restraining orders." The doctor's comparison of cancer, which the afflicted patient cannot get away from, with the risks posed by an estranged husband, which the woman can get away from, is not only callous, but dangerously flawed. Since so many women die as a result of this type of careless thinking, and because most of those deaths are preventable, I'm going to go several layers deeper into the topic. I hope you never need this information for yourself, but I know that someone in your life will need it sometime. Many homicides have occurred at the courthouse where the women are seeking protection orders or just prior to the hearings. Why? Because the murderers were allergic to rejection. They found it hard enough in private, but intolerable in public. For men like this, rejection is a threat to the identity, the persona, to the entire self, and in this sense their crimes could be called murder in defense of the self. In To Have or to Harm, the first major book on stalking, author Lyndon Gross details case after case in which court orders did not prevent homicides. Here are just a few. Shirley Lowry was waiting outside the courtroom for the TRO hearing when she was stabbed 19 times by her husband. Tammy Marie Davis's husband beat and terrorized her and their 21-month-old child, sending them both to the hospital. Right after he was served with the restraining order Tammy obtained, he shot and killed her. She was 19 years old. Donna Montgomery's husband had held a gun to her head and stalked her, so she obtained a restraining order. He came to the bank where she worked and killed her, then himself. Teresa Bender obtained a restraining order that her husband quickly violated. Even though he was arrested, she remained so committed to her safety that she arranged for two male co-workers to accompany her to and from work. Her husband was equally committed. He shot all three to death before turning the gun on himself. Maria Navarro called 911 and reported that her estranged husband had just threatened to kill her and was on the way to her house. Despite the fact that he'd been arrested more than once for battery, police declined to dispatch officers to her home because her restraining order had expired. Maria and three others were dead within 15 minutes, murdered by the man who kept his promise to kill. Hilda Rivera's husband had violated two restraining orders and had six arrest warrants when he killed her in the presence of their 7-year-old son. Betsy Murray's husband violated his TRO 13 times. He reacted to her divorce petition by telling her, "Marriage is for life, and the only way out is death." When nothing else worked, Betsy went into hiding. And even after police assured her that her husband had fled the country to avoid being arrested again, she still kept her new address a secret. When she stopped by her old apartment one day to collect mail a neighbor had been